I think we'll get started. It's a pleasure for me to introduce Alejandro Sanchez, who is inaugurating the current season of the Wednesday afternoon lecture series. Alejandro was born in Caracas in Venezuela, and he came to the U.S. to do his bachelor's degree at Vanderbilt University. He then went on to get his PhD at the University of Cincinnati School of Medicine, and his interest in stem cells began at this stage, where he was studying mouse embryonic stem cells and their differentiation in vitro. In 1994, he began work as a postdoctoral fellow with Don Brown's lab in the Department of Embryology at the Carnegie Institute of Washington, which is located in Baltimore. And in 1995, he was appointed to the independent position of staff associate. It was at this stage that Alejandro made a very bold move. He went back to the drawing board to determine which animal model system would provide the best opportunity to unravel the secrets of metazoan regeneration. He immersed himself in the library with classical literature on regeneration done by embryologists in the past and emerged with the decision to use the planaria as a model system. We all learned in our biology classes how these creatures have the remarkable ability to completely regenerate after they are cut up into small pieces. Alejandro recognized their potential. He was not deterred by the absence of molecular tools to study them. Rather, seeing it as an opportunity, he decided to develop cellular, molecular, and genetic tools to bring the system into the fold of modern biology. In 2002, Alejandro moved to the Department of Neurobiology and Anatomy at the University of Utah School of Medicine, and in 2005, he was promoted to professor and appointed a Howard Hughes Medical Institute investigator. I visited Alejandro in 1998 in Baltimore as he was just starting on this new adventure. What he and his colleagues have achieved in the past 10 years is nothing short of spectacular. They have identified homologous components of all the major metazoan signaling pathways, developed tools for knocking down their genes with RNA technology, and their research is providing novel insights in many aspects of biology and medicine. Their work contributes most obviously to stem cell biology and the mechanisms of regeneration. However, their work is also contributing to our growing recognition that many of the molecular mechanisms involved in development and repair of the human body evolved long ago in common metazoan ancestors. And their work shows how understanding the evolution of different genetic networks and their function in different animal model systems provides unique insight about their role in human development and disease. So with that introduction, I'd like to invite Alejandro to give his talk.
Yeah, thanks very much, Ajay, for that introduction. So I'm hoping to live up to that, to the expectations of that introduction. And what I thought I would do today is to present to you a number of unpublished material and put in perspective the rationale for embarking on this particular type of approach to try to dissect the molecular and cellular basis of processes such as tissue homeostasis and regeneration proper. And I'm starting my seminar with this slide because I really like it. This is October 31st, 1940, FDR. Comes to inaugurate the NIH on this campus right at the beginning of World War II. So it seems to me that history tells us that there will be more presidents that like the NIH as much as FDR, perhaps. So what I'm going to do is divide my talk into two sections. What we're trying to do to dissect tissue homeostasis and what we're trying to do to dissect the problem of regeneration. So I want to start with a quote that seems nonsensical, but it comes from the literature, the artistic literature. This is Alice's Adventure in Wonderland by Lewis Carroll, where Alice actually says, "At least I know who I was when I got up this morning, but I think I must have changed several times since then." Now, that's supposed to be nonsensical, but in fact, that actually is happening to us on a daily basis. So it's been estimated that in a single day, as adults, we lose the equivalent and replace at the same time between 50 to 70 billion cells in a single day. If you do the math, in a single year, each of us will actually produce and eliminate at the same time a mass of cells that is equivalent to our body weight. That is truly remarkable. That means that as years go by, we're constantly changing, and yet, under these well-defined and stable external appearance belies significant change. So in other words, development, as I see it, doesn't really end with embryology. It continues until essentially we just die. So that brings me to the next topic, which is, you know, how do we die of old age? So what happens? I mean, we have spent a significant amount of time defining the beginning of life. When are we born and when life begins? But we really have spent very little time trying to identify the beginning of death. You know, if you look at individuals that live for a very long time and just die because of old age, there's no physiological or pathological condition to that individual passing away. It's not entirely clear why this is happening. So we really don't know what it means to die of old age. And we also don't know, of course, if we think of it in binary terms, when does death begin? So one example of a molecular example of why these actual changes in our physiology occur as we age chronologically is illustrated by some of the work that was carried out in Sean Morrison's laboratory following the fate of the same population of stem cells in the neuronal stem cell system. So this particular study, what they were able to show is that a number of molecules are being activated and deployed specifically during particular periods of the lifetime of the individual to regulate the capacity of these stem cells to proliferate. So as you can see, the capacity for self-renewal and proliferation of these neuronal stem cells is very high during fetal mouse development. During youth, also, it's significantly upregulated, so there's a lot of proliferation. But as the cells get old and the individual gets old, this capacity to self-renew and proliferation is significantly decreased. So there are metrics to measure these kinds of activities. So essentially what we see is the following, is that as we're born, there's a large amount of cells undergoing proliferation, which allows this remarkable growth that we see in our children as they go from 1 week to the next, and that this particular rate of proliferation eventually begins to decrease in time. And what we also see is that the amount of cell turnover also increases with time. So you can imagine this as being some sort of a yin and yang between cell proliferation and cellular turnover, such that at some point the balance will be tipped in one way or the other. This is a significantly variable range because there are individuals such as this person right here. He's a centenarian. He's perfectly normal. Blood pressure is fine. All counts of blood profile is perfectly fine. So the genetic background is there to allow for a big amplitude of the manifestation and distribution of this particular cell kinetics. But what if I were to tell you that there are organisms out there in the wild that actually have figured out a solution to this problem, and the problem has been solved by maintaining the rate of cell proliferation and turnover equivalent, such that they essentially cancel each other out. And that's the animal that we work with. It's one example of many. It's the Planarian Schmittea mediterranea. So I'm going to introduce to you what these animals look like in this movie right here. So what this is a worm that's about to begin to eat. This is a capillary where we put a food extract. You can see the pharynx coming out. And this pharynx is the mouth opening to the gastric system, and they begin to just ingest all of the food. As you can see, they have very complicated behavior. They're homing to the source of food, find the opening, and somehow coordinate their activity such that they can actually ingest the food. Now, these animals, of course, look very different from you and I. But one thing that is very peculiar to these animals, which is conserved with most Amazonian organisms, is that in their body plans lies a population of undifferentiated stem cells. As an adult, that are responsible for producing all of the cell types that make up this animal. And so these cells were originally described in 1892 by Harry Randolph, and she termed these cells neoblasts. So what you can see right now is that they share a particular attribute with all other stem cells that have been described so far, most of them at least, and that is a large decondensed nuclei and very little cytosol. And so in this electron micrograph, what you can see is that there's very few areas of condensed material, which is the heterochromatin of the nucleus. But most of this DNA is essentially open and ready for transcription, so to speak. And the cytosol is heavily laden with RNAs, particularly ribosomes and untranslated messenger RNA. So these are known to be the planarian stem cells, and I'll give you the evidence for why we think that is true in the next few slides. So where are they?
So since these are the only cells capable of undergoing cell division or entering the cell cycle in planarians, you can provide these animals with a single pulse of BRDU and immediately detect where they are located. So this is where the BRDU is incorporated into the cells. You can see they're essentially all over the animal, with two exceptions, the pharynx proper, which is entirely postmitotic, and the area in front of the photoreceptors, which is also entirely postmitotic. And so one can use BRDU to follow the fate of these labeled cells as you allow the BRDU to move with the cells as the cells begin to differentiate. Excuse me, and this is illustrated here. So here's 12 hours after introduction of BRDU. By 4.5 days, we can see the division progeny tagged with BRDU moving in front of the photoreceptors, such that by 6 days, we can already begin to see the columnar epithelium of these animals, their nuclei decorated with a BRDU signal, suggesting then that the division progeny are actually homing to the appropriate tissues as these tissues turn over in time. And these rates of turnover also vary significantly. Now, the other thing that planarians can do, which is actually quite peculiar, is that they can actually regulate their size by growing and degrowing. And this is all based on how this balance between cell turnover and cell proliferation is being regulated. So here's an example of an animal that's about 0.5 millimeters in length. So this is a graph paper right here. Each square is a millimeter square. And what you can see essentially is that if you feed the animal, it'll grow, in this particular case, to about 5 millimeters. So now if you stop feeding the animal, what you would expect would happen is that it'll get skinny and, you know, be sort of in a diet. But that's not what happens. What happens now is that they begin to cannibalize the differentiated cells to keep the neoblasts, which are constantly dividing, happy. So the animals essentially just degrow. They shrink in size, and they do this allometrically. And they're not doing this by reducing the size of the cells, but by actually and actively eliminating cell numbers. And these animals, as they undergo this dramatic change, you essentially see no obvious changes to their behavior, function, motility, and so forth. So they're really indistinguishable from their well-fed cohorts. And so that's very remarkable because they're going to be shrinking a central nervous system and still working just fine, the body wall musculature, all the parenchyma, epithelial cells, and what have you. So at this particular level of resolution, the degrowing animals are perfectly normal. If we now look at where these animals fit in the tree of life of metazoans, what we find is that they belong to a group of animals that's been thoroughly under-characterized in the laboratory, in the modern laboratory. This is so-called Lophotrichozoans. So they're present right here. They are a sister group to the Dysozoa, which contain Drosophila and C. elegans, and also a sister group to our lineage, the Deuterostome lineage, which goes from the tunicates all the way up, of course, to humans. And so essentially what you see is that all of these three groups of metazoans, they all share a common ancestor right here when animals began to be radially symmetric to bilaterally symmetric. So all of these animals essentially come from a common ancestor, and each of them, of course, have, you know, a variety of biological processes. Unfortunately, when we start thinking about what is invertebrate biology, the representative to that biology has been these organisms right here because they are the most heavily studied. And it's become pretty apparent that there are a number of things that mammals do that Drosophila and C. elegans essentially don't do. And so it's been assumed that all of the other invertebrates outside of the deuterostomes are going to behave this way. So how simple are planarians? So they are bilaterally symmetric, and they're triploblastic, which means that they have derivatives of all three germ layers. They have ectoderm, mesoderm, and endoderm. And you can see here that even though they are acoelomates, so there's no cavity, no internal body cavity that maintains or keeps all of these organs, they actually have very complex organ systems that are essentially layered on top of each other along the DV axis as if they were a geological strata. So you can see, for example, the endoderm represented here. Here's the pharynx that I showed you earlier in the movie. That is connected to a gastrovascular system where the food essentially is irrigated throughout the body of the animal. There is a system to regulate salts and fluid, essentially their kidneys, known as pronephridium. Their central nervous system is relatively complex with two cephalic ganglia and two ventral cords that traverse the length of the animal, both of which are connected by commissural neurons. And they also come in two flavors, completely obligatory asexual strains and then sexual strains, which happen to be hermaphrodites. So if you look at the karyotype of these animals, what you see is that they have four pairs of chromosomes. And we picked this species in particular because the genome size is about the size of the first four human chromosomes. And it has four pairs of chromosomes, and they are stable diploids, suggesting that, you know, some of the rules that we understand about DNA segregation and so forth might be applicable to the study of these animals. What we found also is that the asexual strain, which essentially reproduces through mitosis, the way these animals do it for the reproduction is that the tail will adhere to the substratum in which they're in, the head will begin to crawl away from the tail, and as it crawls away, it forms a little waist that just pinches off. And you end up with a headless tail and a tailless head, both of which will go on to regenerate the missing parts, essentially cloning each other, producing two complete animals that are just planarians again. And this particular type of asexual reproduction is associated with this Robertsonian translocation of one of the arms of chromosome 1 to chromosome 4. And when this translocation is detected in these animals, they essentially become obligatory asexually reproducing animals. Now, they are coelomates. They have a blind gut, so they don't have an opening for a mouth and anus. Essentially, the pharynx serves as both the mouth and the anus, and this organ is affectionately called in my lab the manus. This particular structure, you know, was thought to be a primordial version of our gut, of the way in which the openings in our body are formed during embryogenesis. So it was thought for a long time that the reason for this was because the number of Hox genes in these organisms might actually be smaller than the number you'd find in mammals, for example, or the deuterostomes. So we were able to annotate the genome, which was sequenced by WashU and through funding through the NSGRI. And essentially what we have been able to find, though, is that even though these animals have a blind gut and they don't have a coelom, their Hox complement is actually quite complete. There's actually many more Hox genes in the posterior part of this complex than there are in Drosophila and C. elegans, which is shown right here, suggesting that perhaps it's not really the number of Hox genes that actually determines the final morphology, but the way in which these genes are being deployed in time and space for the formation of the structure of, or anatomy of these animals. So that actually made it really interesting to us because we began to see that there were a series of relationships that were playing out between planarians and the deuterostomes that were not playing out between Drosophila, C. elegans, and the deuterostomes. We immediately began to notice that there's a number of genes, in fact, a number of genes in the planarian genome for which we cannot find strict orthologs in Drosophila and C. elegans, but we could find them in the human genome. And so we decided to actually begin to look at these kinds of differences to see whether or not the gene representation might actually correlate also with the function of these genes. And so we began to look at regulators of cell proliferation. In this particular case, I'm going to show you evidence for P10, which planarians actually have and Drosophila also have. But they do very different things. So in P10 is a molecule that has been associated with at least 50% of all human cancers have a mutation in P10. And so it's known to be a tumor suppressor. It has multiple functions in a number of different activities. And essentially, this is the region of the phosphatase region that actually produces these, where most of the mutations are. If you now overlay on top of this sequence, the sequence of planarians, of the Escherichia mediterranea P10, what we find is that there is a high degree of conservation right here. These are strict conservation between the predicted protein sequence of Mediterranea and P10. And what you can see, essentially, is that the phosphatase region is 100% conserved. There's no difference between the two of them. So this is interesting to us because in Drosophila, essentially, it's the same thing. You have a very similar conservation of structure between the two. But in Drosophila, when you silence or eliminate P10 by genetics, you do not get tumor suppression. You actually get a modification on the regulation of the size of the cells. So it was thought for a long time that perhaps these tumor suppressors that work as such in adult mammals, that particular behavior arose in the vertebrate condition, but that in Drosophila they were using a more ancestral type of function, in this particular case, the regulation of size. So you can see the omatidia here are completely expanded in this animal, so the cells are significantly larger, and they didn't cause any type of tumor suppression at all. So no tumors or ectopic growths were observed in Drosophila. So we decided to see whether or not this rule might actually be maintained between the P10 of planarians and the P10 of Drosophila and humans. And essentially what we find is the following, is that there are two copies of P10, these are orthologs of these molecule in planarians, and when we silence them individually, we see no phenotypes, neither the enlargement of cells nor the appearance of tumors. However, we silence both of these genes, what we begin to see is that these animals begin to resorb their heads, and they begin to grow these terrible outgrowths, and eventually the animal dies within 13 days after the appearance of these abnormal growths, suggesting that perhaps P10 was actually regulating a cell proliferation in these animals. So we decided to look, and we looked by using an antibody against the phosphorylated version of histone H3. This is a phosphorylation that occurs between the G2 to M transition, and you can see here the animals that were silenced for the planarian P10 1 and 2, and essentially since these are flat animals, we can actually count every single spot on these specimens and quantify them. So essentially looking at the entire population dynamics of proliferation, not just of a single cell population in culture, but actually in a complete animal. And what we see is a dramatic increase in the number of cells that are actually entering the cell cycle. And you can see that right here. This is about 60 or so mitoses per millimeter, and it's essentially quadruple in the animals that where ESMET P10 1 and 2 have been silenced, suggesting that P10 in planarians may actually be behaving like a tumor suppressor. So suggesting the possibility that perhaps these animals can actually be used to model some of the aspects of tumor suppression mechanisms. The other thing that we noticed as well is that not only did we see an increase in proliferation of these cells, but we also saw an increase in the number of cells total that are found in these animals. And that's illustrated right here. So this is a cross-section of these animals. All of the cells here are labeled with cytox, which labels DNA. And you can see here already in the epithelium is a unicellular layer of epidermis of columnar epithelial cells surrounding this structure. And when you look at the animals that have been affected with or silenced or targeted for ESMET P10 1 and 2, we see now that there's an increase in cellularity in the epithelium and likely also in all these other tissues that are composing the animal. The other thing that we also notice is that since these stem cells are actually going to be producing progeny that will go on to differentiate into the different types of cells that are found in the organism, we thought, well, is the lineages or the division progeny of these cells being affected? And what we find is that in all layers where we looked, whether it's ectoderm, endoderm, or mesoderm, we actually see defects. So this is an antibody against the photoreceptor neurons of the animals. Here's the two pigment cups and the photoreceptor neurons. Here's the basket weave of body wall musculature that essentially envelops the whole animal. And some of these sensory cilia that are found expressed on the dorsal surface of the animal. And in all cases in which P10 was silenced, we essentially see that these tissues can no longer be maintained, suggesting then that what we're doing is really affecting the fate of the stem cells to actually produce the sufficient division progeny, sufficient numbers to maintain the form and function of these animals. If we now do the histology and we look closely to see where these cells go and what happens, it appears as if these cells are actually metastasizing into different compartments of the animal. So here's my favorite slide, where you can see the columnar epithelial cells right here. There's an obvious basement membrane right here. And you can see some of these neoblasts, which are labeled darkly in blue, just present in here. And here's a cross-section of the pharynx as well. And you can see some of these division progeny of neoblasts, also labeled in blue, as shown right here. And what we see essentially is that in these places where these massive outgrowths are appearing on these animals, we see an infiltration of these cells, undifferentiated cells, breaking down the basement membrane and beginning to accumulate abnormally in these areas where they normally should not be. And the same thing happens in other organs such as the pharynx. You can essentially see the entire pharynx populated by these excess cells. So it appears as if the cells are proliferating, but they're not differentiating properly, but they nonetheless home and migrate and begin to repopulate the animal in an abnormal fashion. So as we were working on this line of investigation on this gene, Sean Morrison published a really interesting paper where they show that if they knock out the function of P10 on the stem cells of the hematopoietic compartment, what would happen there is that they would get the same kind of phenotype, cellularization and leukemia. It's just a complete loss of regulation of the hematopoietic compartment. But the remarkable thing about these findings was that if they now introduced a molecule, rapamycin, which is downstream from the P10 activity and essentially should rescue the activity, they were able to actually rescue the mice. I rescued them to normal levels where the excess proliferation was abrogated, normal proliferation was maintained, and the appropriate division progeny from the hematopoietic lineage were made, and the animals survived just fine. So this is the same mutant, but just being fed rapamycin. So we thought we would try the same experiment in planarians. And essentially what we find are identical results, or very similar results in that regard. So essentially what we see is the following. So here's the normal rate of proliferation in animals that in the wild-type control. And so you can see it's about 60 mitoses per millimeter or so. Addition of rapamycin causes absolutely no change in the number of mitotic figures, suggesting that the animals can actually sense between regular proliferation and any kind of excess proliferation. So rapamycin is not inhibiting that process. However, when we introduce or silence both P10s, 1 and 2, as I showed you earlier, there's an increase in proliferation, which can actually now be rescued back to essentially normal levels, but never below normal levels in the presence of rapamycin. This actually rescues the animals from forming these outgrowths and actually allow the animals also to regenerate normally, which is shown right here. So that already tells us that these particular tumor suppressors are actually present in these organisms, not so much to prevent a disease or so, but to actually regulate how much hyperproliferation is required in an appropriate biological context to produce a favorable outcome. In this particular case, either tissue homeostasis or proliferation of new cells to restore body parts that are lost to injury or amputation. All right. So if you compare the results between mouse and planaria and the fruit flies, this is essentially what we find. That in flies, essentially elimination of P10 does not cause any increase in proliferation, and obviously no increased cellularity, but whether or not there's a rapamycin rescue has not been reported. And essentially all of these criteria are met by this organism, something that we had not really anticipated, but that's how the data played out. And so we think now that planarians may actually provide us with a novel invertebrate model system in which it might be possible to model specific aspects of tumor suppression mechanisms. So this actually argues then that the stem cells in these animals are under strict proliferative control. But the animals as a whole have to make a decision as to what types of specific lineages need to be made in order to keep the form and function of the animals. So this is a collection of purified cells. This is the nice thing about working with an invertebrate, an aquatic invertebrate. You can place these animals into a calcium magnesium-free media, and what happens there is that all of the cells lose their attachment to each other, and you end up with a soup of cells. Now, you can label the cells and look at them under the microscope, and what we find is that about 25 to 30% of all of the cells in these animals have this morphology. These are the neoplasts, the stem cells in these animals. So it's an abundant and accessible, experimentally accessible population of stem cells. Large nuclei, very little cytosol. And then, of course, you find a variety of differentiated cells. Here's a neuron. Here's a monocillated cilia, sensory neuron. This is part of the gastric system, and this is part of the epidermis, and a variety of other cell types whose identity remain to be determined. But we estimate anywhere between 30 to 40 different cell types. All of these cells will make the neurons, the central nervous system, the gastrovascular system, all of which are also turning over at different rates. So epithelium turns over quicker than neurons do. Muscle is the second fastest turning over tissue, and then neurons are the slowest to turn over. And so when these cells divide, they need to produce just the right amount of cells in order to keep the form and function of these organ systems. So what we thought we would do is that we thought that we could take advantage of irradiation to try to identify stem cell-associated genes. And the reason we thought about this is because it was shown in 1902 by Betcher that if you expose these animals to a crystal of cesium, the animals lost their capacity to maintain their tissue homeostasis and also to establish a regenerative activity. And when you look at the histology of these animals, what you see is that the animals are completely devoid of these undifferentiated cells. 25 to 30% of them, they're all gone. And now the animals survive on the virtue of their differentiated cells until 2 or 3 weeks later, when the epithelium begins to turn over, there is no fresh division progeny to replace those cells, and the animals essentially just lies. So we thought we could do a comparative analysis, kind of like a subtractive study, between wild-type animals and irradiated animals to try to identify genes that were absent in the irradiated animals, and we surmised that those genes might actually be associated with the function of these stem cells. or with the stem cells proper. So essentially, that's what we did. This is the work of a graduate student in the laboratory, George Eisenhofer. And essentially, what you're seeing here are three replicas showing how reproducible these microarrays actually work. And essentially, we see the following. We find about 165 genes that are significantly downregulated within 24 hours after irradiation. We know that the cell cycle length in these animals is approximately 18 hours. So we assume that if the genes are going away after 24 hours, that they might be associated with the cells that are no longer there, and therefore we'll see a decrease. Then we also found a second population of genes that were present at 24 hours but completely lost at 7 days after irradiation. And we thought that perhaps those are cells that are turning over and may actually help us to identify markers to the immediate division progeny, post-mitotic progeny of this neoblast. So the nice thing about working with an invertebrate system is that you can take your laundry list of genes and you can immediately determine where in the animal these genes are expressed. So we can do that by in situ hybridization. And what George actually found out is that the genes that were identified on either day 1 or day 7 post-irradiation fell kind of neatly in three general categories of expression patterns, so-called categories 1, 2, and 3. And category 4, these are ubiquitous expression, and we think we detect them as downregulated because tissues are turning over within a week. But essentially what we find is that all of the genes that disappear after 24 hours of irradiation are strictly associated with the neoblast, with the stem cell proper. So we were able to identify at least 24 markers that are specific to this neoblast. And so we also found expression of a second population of genes in a discrete subpopulation of cells, with the distinction that now we see expression in front of the photoreceptors, which are highlighted with this asterisk right here, and also some expression in the pharynx. And we know that these two areas are devoid of mitotically active cells. So we thought that perhaps these cells are division progeny from these neoblasts, all conjectural at this point. And then we saw even more radially distributed cells that are more superficial in the body plan of these animals. So by doing a double fluorescent in situ hybridization, we wanted to determine whether or not these expression patterns were exclusive of each other or were coincident with each other. And essentially what we find is that genes in category 1 are really different from category 2. There's essentially very little co-expression between these two cell types. And the same thing is true between category 1 and category 3, where we essentially see no overlap of expression between these two general categories of gene expression. But we do find some overlap between categories 2 and 3. Very little, but there's some right there. And I'll show you evidence in a minute to suggest that actually these category 2 genes are expressing cells that will eventually begin to express these category 3 genes. So just to give you an idea of the spatial distribution of these different markers shown in this movie, so in green are these genes expressed in the stem cells, and these category 2 genes are a little bit more superficial along the DV axis. So you can see there's essentially no overlap, and you can now see as you get closer and closer to the edge of the animal that you begin to see the expression of these category 2 genes, essentially telling us that there really is very little overlap in the whole animal as we look at them in situ. If we now look at categories 1 and 3, we essentially see the same thing I just told you, and that is a lack of overlap between the two. Here's the stem cells labeled with this marker. It's the planarian ortholog of peewee. And again, the expression of this category 3 gene is significantly more superficial than the other categories 2 and 3. And then when you do categories 2 and 3 together, this is when you actually see that there's significant overlap. So you can see a lot of white cells suggesting that some of the cells expressing category 2 at some point begin to express this category 3. So that gave us a general idea that perhaps what we're looking at was not just markers of subpopulations of cells, but perhaps lineage markers of this population of stem cells in the whole animal. So we wanted to test that. And so the first thing that we did was to see how quickly does the signal decay after exposure to irradiation of each of these three different categories. So here's category 1. 24 hours after irradiation, the signal is essentially completely gone, suggesting that, in fact, these genes are really expressed in the cells because after 24 hours, they have been physically removed. Category 2 genes, on the other hand, we see significant decrease, but there's still some cells expressing these markers. But by day 2, the genes are essentially undetectable. And by day 4, they're just gone and they never come back, suggesting that either these cells are actually coming from these stem cells or that these genes are being expressed in a temporally regulated fashion. And category 3 are the most long-lasting genes of the series, and you can detect them all the way up to 2 to 3 days post-irradiation, and eventually they also go away. So we thought, again, that this was circumstantial evidence to suggest that each of these cells present in this or marked by these different categories may have their origins directly from this stem cell from the neoblast. So to address that issue, what we decided to do was to introduce BRDU in the animals and then lay on top of that expression detection of these different categories of genes in the organism. And what we find is the following. So about 99% of all of the cells expressing the category 1 genes get labeled with BRDU within 8 hours after introduction of this thymidine analog. And we see essentially no overlap of BRDU and expression between categories 2 and categories 3. So if we now move and let the pulse, chase the pulse for several hours, and we now fix the animals 48 hours after introduction of the initial pulse, now we see that most of the BRDU is not present in the stem cells that are labeled here in green, but we actually see co-localization of a BRDU signal with these category 2 genes. So since these cells came actually from here, that suggests that this might actually be the immediate division progeny of these stem cells in these animals. But we don't see much overlap between these two particular markers, the BRDU and the category 3 genes, by 2 days. Now, if we let it go all the way to 4 days, now what we see is essentially that most of the category 3 genes are double-labeled with BRDU. Very little is left by 4 days after after the BRDU has traversed through these cells, and essentially no double labeling between BRDU and the category 1 stem cell markers is shown. So essentially what we're seeing is that cells are born here, they incorporate BRDU, express a particular cohort of genes, then they move, physically move, migrate out of this compartment more radially along the DV and AP axis into more superficial areas that are now labeled with BRDU, express a new category of genes, and so forth and so on, until these cells eventually will go on to differentiate into the appropriate tissue types. So the reason why these experiments are important to us is because even though we have a population of stem cells that are essentially absolutely required for the normal functioning and survival of these animals, the lineage of these cells is completely unknown. Now, it's relatively straightforward to try to figure out lineages in vitro, but what we would like to do with this animal is to actually study the population dynamics of stem cell regulation in vivo. And so we need to have tools that will allow us to distinguish, you know, daughter cell from daughter cell from daughter cell and the different stages along the differentiation lineage of these cells. And so I think these markers actually do this for us. So these results essentially allow us to conclude the following. That the stem cell proper are essentially localized internally. It's somewhere inside of the animal and surrounded by the gastrovascular system. So we are speculating at the moment that this is essentially the niche that allows for these stem cells to self-renew and proliferate inside of the animal. As these cells begin to migrate outside of the of this area, this is a cross-section, dorsal and ventral being here, they now begin to turn off these genes. The genes that label the stem cells are beginning to express these other genes, either categories 2 and 3. So if you look at a coronal section of this animal, this is what it essentially looks like. So all of the stem cells are somehow in direct association with the endoderm right here. And then as the cells begin to migrate away from this compartment, they begin to differentiate, suggesting then that even though these stem cells appear to be distributed in random locations along the body plan of the animal, that there actually is temporal and spatial regulation on the way in which these genes are being activated or repressed as the cells begin to replace tissues that are undergoing turnover. So this is a very primitive but relatively accurate way of thinking about how these stem cells are actually beginning to produce the different lineages that give rise to all of the cell types in these animals. So we think that these stem cells now are producing a transitory population of cells labeled by these category 2 genes that will, some of them, will actually go on to express these category 3 genes. We also know that there are other genes that are not expressed in these cells that may be labeling these cells. So this is actually beginning to branch out significantly as early as the immediate division progeny of the cells, suggesting that the lineages are going to be arborized very rapidly and very efficiently after the cells, the stem cells, divide and self-renew. So that is essentially what we've been trying to do, is to try to characterize some of the lineage activities that are taking place in this really remarkable stem cell population in planarians. But the thing that planarians are better known for is their capacity to regenerate. And I think everybody who's been in high school in this country or even in South America knows about planarians, that if you slice and dice them in a variety of ways, they'll actually go on to regenerate into complete animals. So here is a good time to actually bring to your attention what I think are really significant differences between the process of embryogenesis and the process of regeneration. Because many people actually suggest the idea that regeneration is nothing but a recapitulation of embryonic processes. But unlike embryogenesis, which has a very well-defined beginning, this one you know, this is a zebrafish embryo, undergoing gastrulation and differentiation, we know that that actually begins with the fertilization. There's a very well-defined, evolutionarily selected process by which these animals reproduce sexually. However, when you are an adult and you are at the mercy of the environment, there are a number of things that the body needs to do in order to survive in that environment. So I think that regeneration does not have a defined beginning. It's actually an ad hoc beginning because the animal really doesn't know how it's going to be injured and what is it that it's going to have to deploy in order to restore the missing body parts. So I'm going to give you an example. Now, this is a Photoshop image, so no starfish were hurt in this in the making of this slide, okay? So, but essentially what I'm doing is the following. Here's an amputation that's perpendicular to the splane of the proximal distal axis of the arm, a jagged edge, a circular amputation, a diagonal amputation, and these animals will actually go on to restore those body parts. So the geometry is completely different and unpredicted, and yet the pre-existing tissue can somehow activate a number of genes and activate a number of things to restore the appropriate form and function. That's something that does not happen during embryogenesis. The other thing that doesn't happen during embryogenesis is that regeneration really requires the functional integration of these newly formed body parts to pre-existing tissue. So if you regenerate a new eye, that needs to be rewired again to the retinal tectum. So whether you have ipso or contralateral projections, that actually is going to be regenerated. So it's a complete integration, functional integration of the newly formed tissues. Also, the regenerate is out of proportion with the body size. So sometimes you get a regenerate that's very, very small. This happens in salamanders. Their limbs after the regenerate are significantly smaller in relation to the proportion of the rest of the animal. So it needs to grow to reach the appropriate size and not grow too much or too little. Otherwise, it will be absolutely unfunctional. And sometimes, depending on the plane of amputation, the type of injuries or insults that the animals receive, will actually produce animals that are no longer bilaterally symmetric. You could have an animal that now is amputated this way, and the very, very tip of that plane is more anterior, and the very, very bottom is more posterior along the AP axis of that animal. And yet, somehow, it needs to reshape such that the appropriate coordinates along the AP axis can be reestablished and the animal can resume its normal body plan. And sometimes, as well, the physical distribution of the regenerated structures is inappropriate and abnormal. So sometimes, in the cases of some of the animals that regenerate missing body parts, you'll find that a particular organ is juxtaposed on top of another organ where they normally don't lie in the adult animal. And they need to sort each other out such that they assume their appropriate locations along the AP axis of the animal. And this is actually easily illustrated by the regeneration of head snails, which was an experiment that was carried out by Lazarus Spallanzani in the late 18th century. And essentially what he noticed was is that you can take one of these snails and amputate and remove their head, essentially, and they'll actually go on to regenerate that head. So this is an adult animal, has, you know, the little shell and so forth, and the head will need to be reformed, reconnected, and allow the animal to resume its proper form and function. So Voltaire actually learned about this experiment. And so upon learning about, you know, that the snails could actually regenerate their heads, he would actually go on to say that for many people, such a change would be nothing but a great improvement. What Voltaire did not know, though, is that his compatriots, 12 years later, would put this experiment to the test, cut the heads of many people, and not see any type of head regeneration, obviously. But this actually brings me to the next point, which is if regeneration really is a footnote of developmental biology, and if, in fact, you know, it's just a recapitulation of embryogenesis, you would expect that only a few animals under appropriate selective pressure would actually have regenerative capacities. But it turns out that's not really the case. So if you look at every phyla in the Minnesotan Tree of Life, you will find species with truly remarkable regenerative capacities. And so what I have done here is to highlight all of the different phyla where it's been described unambiguously the capacity to regenerate missing body parts after amputation in adult animals. And the ones that are in black essentially have not been tested. So I don't know if they'll actually be able to mount a regenerative response or not. The other thing that's interesting about this tree is that regeneration actually takes place in even the simplest animals, from placozoans to tenophores, all the way up to vertebrates, suggesting perhaps that regeneration really is an ancestral attribute of multicellularity that has been associated with multicellular organisms since the origins of life. So planarians are really good at regenerating missing body parts. And so what I'm going to show you now is what these animals can do when you slice and dice them in a variety of ways. So here's an animal with the brain schematized here in the anterior part of the animal, where essentially what we've done is run a razor blade prepharyngeally, here's the pharynx, and postpharyngeally, and you end up with three fragments that have defined polarity along this axis. And what you see in time is that each of these fragments will actually go on to regenerate the missing body parts. So this trunk will actually go on to regenerate or form a regeneration blastema anteriorly and posteriorly at the same time and go on to regenerate a complete animal such that by day 7, pretty much this animal has all of its proper organs. They're not in the appropriate allometry, but they'll eventually resolve itself. But these animals essentially behave pretty much the same way that the uncut amputated animals. And if you follow the anterior and posterior fragments right here, the head and the tail, they'll actually go on to regenerate the tail or the head, depending on where along the axis of the anterior-posterior axis these fragments might be. This particular problem is compounded by the following, and that is that these animals can really be amputated in a variety of ways, all of which will result in the regeneration of the missing body parts. So these, again, are experienced by Randolph from 1897 or so, where the animals can be, you know, amputated transversely. They'll go on to regenerate. You can actually cut these animals along the midline, okay, just along the middle of the animal. And each half will go on to regenerate its missing half, essentially regenerating its mirror image and producing two animals. You can cut the animal into 8 fragments. Let's say we amputate transversely 3 times and once longitudinally, and each of those fragments will go on to regenerate complete, you know, planarians. And Randolph and later Morgan, T.H. Morgan, went on to demonstrate that you can remove a fragment that's about 1/279th the size of the whole animal. And that tiny little fragment that's in the flank right here will actually go on to regenerate a planarian. This is a truly remarkable feat of biology because this particular fragment is never made a brain. It's never made a midline. It's in a particular location along the AP axis. And yet, by its excision from the body plan, it can actually reset itself and lay down de novo all of these different coordinates to allow the animal to regenerate, the fragment to regenerate an animal. So the way we actually interrogate this biology is by using RNAi. And so I show you a little bit with the P10 data how this actually works, but I didn't explain it very well. And that is essentially that we can actually introduce double-stranded RNA into these animals, either by injection or by feeding the double-stranded RNA, and observe a robust and reproducible decrease in the transcript levels of a cognate transcript being targeted for abrogation. So in this particular case, it's the opsin molecule. You can see essentially by 6 hours after introduction of double-stranded RNA, the signal is significantly decreased, and by 12 hours is essentially undetectable, and so is by 24 hours. So here's the pigment cup, and the photoreceptor neurons will be right here. So we utilize this methodology to carry out an RNAi screen to identify genes that affect regeneration and tissue homeostasis in these animals. And I don't really have time to tell you about all of the phenotypes that emerge from this, and I'm going to focus on a particular case in just a minute. But suffice it to say that we were able to uncover about 240 phenotypes out of 1,065 genes tested that affected essentially every aspect of regeneration, from wound healing to cell proliferation to the regulation of integration of the newly regenerated tissue to the pre-existing tissues and so forth. And that's been published in these papers right here. But one of the phenotypes that we did not get from that screen is the one that I was really most keen in trying to detect, and that is introducing defects that will actually change the identity of the AP axis. And the reason why I wanted that phenotype is because it had been described before. And it was described by T.H. Morgan. This is work of one of his earliest papers, showing his studies on planarian regeneration. So what he noticed when he did his experiments essentially was the following, that he could take this animal and amputate it a number of ways, in this case 9 different fragments, and he would actually follow these fragments, orient them, and realize that the anterior end of each fragment would always regenerate a head, and the posterior end of each fragment would always regenerate a tail. So he didn't understand why this would be, because even if he looked at tissues that had no obvious physiological or anatomical landmarks, how the cells would actually know where, why they were anterior and why they were posterior. So he thought that perhaps what was happening is that the pre-existing tissue may have been serving as some type of a buffer that actually kept the distance between the two amputation planes. This is his hypothesis as he formulates it. And that this particular pre-existing tissue prevented a direct interaction between these two amputation planes, allowing them to differentiate into either anterior or posterior ends. So he did the following experiment. He reduced the buffering capacity of the tissue. So he tried to cut an animal or a sliver from an animal that was as thin as possible, such that both amputation planes were in as close proximity to each other as possible. And when he did this experiment, he actually got these types of animals that now were able to regenerate heads at both ends of the fragment, essentially producing these bicephalic animals, which he termed Janus head animals in reference to the Roman god for the month of January. And so at the time, he was an assistant professor, and what he concluded from this experiment was that there is something here that is important to find an explanation for. And of course, we agree with that wholeheartedly, because it's really difficult to imagine how this pre-existing tissue may actually be responsible for establishing the polarity of these two regenerated fragments. So we thought that what we would do is the following. We would now focus our attention on the 7 major signaling pathways that have been described and well characterized during embryogenesis in all the model systems that people have worked with in the past 30 years or so, from Drosophila, C. elegans, mice, zebrafish, and so forth. And we would find orthologs of these, each of these components, and then just subject them to RNAi and see what their function of what the function of these pathways may be in the adult condition. So we know a lot about what they do during embryogenesis. We know very little about what these signaling pathways actually do in the adult condition. So one of the first pathways that we went after was the Wnt beta-catenin pathway. So in parentheses here are essentially all the different isoforms that were found in the genome of this organism, so 2 porcupines, 9 Wnts, and so forth. And then, of course, all of the effectors of this pathway, intercellular effectors, the Schevel, APC, and beta-catenin. So Kyle Gurley and Johan Rink, 2 postdoctoral fellows in the lab, set out to systematically silence each of these genes and determine what kinds of phenotypes would emerge from this analysis. So here's the experimental paradigm. So in this particular case, we introduced a C. elegans gene that has no cognate sequence in planarians to just activate the RNAi machinery in these animals, and essentially we amputate them pre- and post-pharyngeally, and then we see what happens to them. That would be our control experiment. And yeah, there we go. So what you can see essentially is that under these conditions, the animals regenerate just fine. The head regenerates a tail. Here's an intact animal. The tail regenerated a head. And there was a trunk right there that regenerated both the head and the tail. So you can tell the newly regenerated tissues because they are highly unpigmented. Okay. So when we now silence beta-catenin in these animals, essentially what we got was a recapitulation of the Janus phenotype that T.H. Morgan described in 1898. So this molecule, these animals obviously are alive. You're looking at a trunk fragment right here. And at both ends, two heads, or what appear to be two heads, regenerated. So it appears as if beta-catenin was somehow affecting the identity of the cells, the pre-existing cells, such that now they will only be able to regenerate heads. So we wanted to know if this type of transformation was just cosmetic or if, in fact, the transformation was as profound as it intimated. So we looked at markers of both endoderm, ectoderm, and mesoderm and see whether or not the transformation was complete along the new regenerate. And essentially, this is what we find. So here's a marker for the central nervous system in planarians. This is prohormone convertase 2, labeling the 2 cephalic ganglia and the 2 ventral cords. And essentially, in these beta-catenin-treated animals for double-stranded RNA, we see that a bona fide acephalic ganglia is formed in these newly regenerated heads, suggesting then that the ectoderm actually is being affected. If we now look at markers that are specific to either the anterior end of the animal, we see now that these beta-catenin animals have expression at both ends, suggesting that transformation is really more than superficial, but it's really as complete as it can possibly be. And if we look at posterior markers, in this case, a wint that is secreted in a gradient from the tip of the tail towards the anterior of the animal, that signal is completely abrogated in the animals that are bicephalic. So the way we designed these screens was to try to also introduce the possibility of generating overexpression paradigms. So we have not been able to develop transgenesis yet in planarians. We're trying as we speak. But what we thought we would do is that, well, maybe one way to actually overexpress the activator, beta-catenin, would be to silence the inhibitor, in this case, the single copy of APC. And then we asked the question, what would happen in an animal where beta-catenin is overexpressed during regeneration? So when we do that experiment, we got a really interesting result, and that is the converse result. Instead of getting two heads at both ends, we actually got two tails to grow at both ends, suggesting that in this pathway, APC and beta-catenin in conjunction are somehow responsible for determining the fate of the tissues that are going to be formed in an adult animal. So you can see here this animal is arcing towards each other because each tail now is in opposite polarity crawling towards each other. And of course, you know, you can see that the animals are just fine, they're alive. So this is another advantage of working with an adult animal where you can introduce this abrogation of gene function. They actually don't produce an embryonic lethal phenotype. You're essentially sidestepping that, and now you can interrogate the function of these molecules in an adult context. So that was actually unexpected. So we went ahead and tried the same kind of characterization to see whether or not these changes were really as profound as they appeared. And as you can see here, this two-tailed animal is completely devoid of cephalic ganglia at both ends. If we look at the anterior marker, it's completely absent at both ends. And if we look now, the posterior marker is now present at both ends of the animals, suggesting that, in fact, what regenerated at both ends were tails. The biggest surprise came when we decided to test whether or not amputation was introducing some type of, you know, injury activation of this pathway. And that's why we were seeing this phenotype. So the one experiment that one can do is to go ahead and introduce a double-stranded RNA against your molecule of choice and leave the animal alone. Don't cut it, just leave it alone. And then see whether or not this actually would cause a phenotype. And what we essentially saw when we did that is that these animals, the intact unamputated animals, would actually begin to grow these little protuberances on the side, and their tails began to develop photoreceptors, what appeared to be eyes. So even in an intact condition, elimination of this pathway was able to change the regulation of the polarity along the AP axis in an intact adult animal, suggesting that the maintenance of these particular properties along the AP and DV axis are actively being regulated in an adult animal. So if we now analyze these animals and we look for the evidence of whether or not those tails actually turn into heads, we use an antibody that I showed you earlier that labels the photoreceptor neurons, same markers I showed you earlier for the CNS and the anterior end, and of course this is the wild-type condition. You see an absence of either of these markers. But in the beta-catenin RNAi-treated intact animals, you see now the emergence of photoreceptors in the tail. You can see the two pigment cups right here, a small brain shown right here, and the expression of this anterior marker. So when you put all this together and you summarize all this together, what you see is that if you get rid of beta-catenin function, you essentially now dictate the newly regenerated tissues and the pre-existing tissues that are turning over to change their identity into cephalic structures. If, on the other hand, you get rid of APC, you now get the opposite. You get an overexpression or overaccumulation of beta-catenin, which now results in a transformation of these tissues into tails. We see the same phenotype with the shovel. So we have to silence both of them together, but we also see other phenotypes that may be related to the planar circularity pathway. But what we cannot find is this. Anything upstream from the shovel produces phenotypes when we silence them, but they do not produce the Janus phenotype. So there's two alternatives. One, that we haven't found the right wint, and so there might be another rogue wint floating around that we haven't identified, or that two, that there's a different way to regulate this part of the pathway to actually produce the effects that I just told you. It may be associated with the multiple functions that beta-catenin may have regarding adhesion as opposed to transcriptional regulation. So what we think we can do with these animals now is that this large collection of neoplasts and this small number of differentiated cell types that are found in their body plant, as well as all the tools that I just had a chance to introduce to you, will allow us to really systematically study in vivo this population of stem cells in a dynamic fashion. In other words, work out the population dynamics of how a stem cell population responds to changes in the environment, amputation, starvation, genotoxic stress, et cetera. We now are convinced or convince ourselves that we can actually measure the biological processes in planarians. We can catalog their genes, which we've done by annotating the genome. And, of course, we can visualize their expression and interfere with their function with RNAi. And so what we hope to accomplish with all this is that this context of regeneration and tissue turnover really presents an opportunity not just to identify novel genes with novel functions, but perhaps also novel functions for known genes. And that's what we're beginning to find for all the signaling pathways, which are now deployed in a different context than embryogenesis and are actually producing consequences that might be somehow not saliently manifested in our own biology, but may actually be happening as we speak. So, of course, none of this work is possible without the work and effort as an incredibly talented group of people I've had an opportunity to work with. So the work on P10 was carried out by a graduate student, Nelson Oviedo. The RNAi screen was carried out by Peter Redin and two undergraduate students, Adam Bermange and Kenny right here. The lineage experiments were carried out by George Eisenhofer, shown right here, and Hara Kang, two graduate students. And the work on beta-catenin APC was carried out by two postdoctoral fellows, Kyle Gurley and Johan Rink, and, of course, the funding from NIGMS and the NHGRI that allowed me to begin to explore in detail the biology of these animals. Thank you.
Sure, Alejandro has some time to answer a few questions.
It was fascinating work. I'm relatively naive about this area, but I had three questions. One had to deal with the planaria's lifespan. Are they immortal?
Yeah, that's a good question. You could say that they're negligibly senescent because the way they escape death is by replacing the dying cells with younger progeny from the neoplasts. So the neoplasts themselves are immortal. So these animals are reproduced exclusively through mitosis, the asexual species. They've been doing this for, you know, millions of years. So in a way, yes, they are, you know, negligibly senescent. Yeah.
Another question has to deal with transplantation. You mentioned that you had two types of planaria,
yes.
Asexual and sexual.
Mm-hmm.
Can you transplant tissue from an asexual to a sexual to make the sexual asexual or bisexual?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah. So, you know, the really interesting a really interesting attribute of the planarian literature is that in the absence of molecular tools, every imaginable amputation and cut and paste experiment has been done and described in great detail. So what people have been able to do is to subject a sexually reproducing animal to irradiation, which essentially gets rid of all of the neoblasts and the gonads, the dividing cells. And you can now transplant a fragment from an asexual animal into it, and those neoblasts will repopulate the body of the sexual animal, and they will never recover their reproductive capacity. You can do the converse experiment, which is to now bring tissue from the sexual animal into an irradiated asexual, and you essentially transform the asexual into the sexual strain. And the reason why this is possible is because these neoblasts are really amazing. They are not only capable of producing all the somatic lineages, but in the adult, they can also regenerate the germline. So there's no obvious segregation of the germline in the embryogenesis of these animals. And the germline is essentially arising as a result of an inductive interaction in a way that might be analogous to the way in which, you know, our germlines in mammals are formed. So, yes, this is possible. It is possible to do this type of experiment.
And there's no rejection.
There is no rejection. No.
And then my last question had to do with your RNAi experiences. RNAi, how you give it, can be transient.
Yes.
Do you find a reversion so that you have a Janus planaria, and then subsequently with time it will revert back into...
Yeah. So no, they don't revert back in time. They retain their identity permanently. What happens, though, is that now both of these heads will begin to interact with the pre-existing tissue and induce the formation of new tails. So now the animals look like a cross, and they're called duplicitas cruciata. Huh. And then if you allow them to fission, at some point they'll actually separate from each other, and you'll end up with two perfectly looking and normal planarians.
Thank you very much. Yeah,
thank you.
I have a two-parter. So is your hypothesis that all animals have a massive regeneration capacity and that it just manifests itself differently in different organisms? Or is it that there might be a selection against massive regeneration capacity in some animals?
Yeah, so that's a really good question for which there really is no obvious answer. But I really think that regenerative capacities are an ancestral attribute, and that in some animals, for reasons we don't understand, it's been actually selected against or selected for. I was thinking about this example where, you know, two species of polychaete worms, marine worms, that actually grow in the same estuaries, they've been subjected to the same selective pressure, and they're bona fide separate species. Their differences are that one is white and the other one is red. Okay, you cut the white one in half, it dies. You cut the red one, it regenerates just fine. So in some phyla, regeneration doesn't appear to be an evolutionary variable. Okay, in others, it appears that it is. So the actual dynamics of how these particular attributes get selected for, allowed to drift, or selected against, that's not known at all. But it is very, very true that almost every animal that actually lives for a very long time, where there is a lot of tissue turnover during their existence, they'll have some capacity to regenerate. I mean, olfactory neurons regenerate constantly, for example. You know, our liver regenerates just fine after hepatectomy. So it's just being, you know, canalized in some particular way that it's not entirely understood. And it appears as if the genes that are driving this type of regenerative capacities, there's nothing special about them. It's just a way in which they're being deployed in time and space to produce a particular outcome. And those rules are the ones that I think we're going to need to understand in order to, you know, harness or reactivate or manipulate regenerative capacities in a variety of tissues and organisms. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So I have one question.
Yes, sir.
So one of the remarkable things about the role of the wind pathway that you showed is that its role, the absence of wind signaling allowing the development of cephalic structures, mm-hmm. is remarkably similar to vertebrates, where yeah. absence of wind signaling also allows cephalic structures to mm-hmm. form. So what I was wondering is, if you now look at the role of, say, the BMP signaling pathway,
yes.
which has a conserved role in DV patterning, do
yes.
you see any parallels there?
Yeah, we do. In fact, we can actually transform an animal that has DV axis into an animal that's just VV, all ventral. And this can be done by introducing double-stranded RNA into an unamputated animal for SMAD4. Okay, so if you get rid of SMAD4, what happens now is that the animals will survive just fine, but after about 3 months of like feeding double-stranded RNA every week to the animal, what you end up having is an animal that's now lost all of his dorsal characteristics, is completely ventralized, and is still alive. And the remarkable thing is that not only is it ventral surfaces at both ends, but inside of the animal, with some frequency, you see the animals trying to make another set of cephalic ganglia that are now juxtaposed on top of each other, making the cell think that, you know, the dorsal structure is somewhere in the middle of the animal. So this plasticity is really one of the hallmarks of these animals. And so it is possible to change that DV axis by elimination of SMAD4. It's also possible now to get rid of the AP axis by getting rid of beta-catenin. And there's probably also some type of left-right asymmetry. We have not uncovered it yet. I don't know what the molecules are, but we know that this bilateral asymmetry is actively maintained, because in our RNAi screen, we actually found genes that will allow regeneration of photoreceptors only one side, but not the other, suggesting that these asymmetries may actually be, you know, actively maintained as well as the symmetries. So, yeah.
One last question.
Hi.
Hello.
It is a good model for adult stem cells,
But now one of the new issues is becoming more like the speed of differentiation, right? So if you were to accelerate the speed of differentiation in this animal, would you expect, like, they were functional, the newborn cells?
I don't understand the question.
Okay, so if the speed of differentiation in this animal were accelerated, okay, like it's been doing now in adult stem cells, would you expect that those animals were functional?
I see. So you mean if the rate of differentiation is accelerated, whether or not the cells will actually come together and give rise to the appropriate form and function?
Yeah,
I don't know. I really don't know. Because you could imagine, well, you might get something like that, but you could imagine some type of mispatterning if you have inappropriate ratios of the cells that are required to give rise to the structures. One example, for example, might be the photoreceptor neurons, of which they are 24 per side. Okay, so you can imagine that, you know, if for whatever reason you get 12 or half of that because they accelerated their morphogenesis quicker at the expense of some other cell, that you might actually get some patterning defects. And some of the RNAi screen results that we got suggest that might be possible. So they do try to self-assemble if you accelerate their kinetics of differentiation, but there's always some type of patterning defect in the cases that we've actually looked at in some detail. Does that answer your question?
Yeah. Okay. Perfect. And the other question would be, do these animals have pain receptors?
Pain receptors?
Yeah, I'm just wondering when you cut them, if they feel something.
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't know. I really don't know. I mean, there's a number of pressure receptors that are found in the mesenchyme, but whether or not they are pain receptors, I'm not sure.
All right.
Yeah. Okay.
So let's thank you.